Department brought in a drone to search from the air. Sauk County dive team was also dispatched. Emergency crews were first dispatched to the boat launch around 6:30 last night, but had to stop searching a couple hours later due to visibility and the weather. Officials have asked the public not to help in the search because they already have enough resources on the water. Company that provides home and respite care to elderly and disabled people around Wisconsin plans to end operations next month and lay off 700 employees. Gemini Cares, based in Slinger, has employees in 11 communities in Wisconsin. Its notice to the State Department of Workforce Development says its current clients will be transferred to the care of other agencies. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Majestic Theater, Fox City's Performing Arts, and Wine Guys play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can join our ever-growing list of supporters. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Portabella Italian Restaurant, featuring homemade Italian dinners, steaks, and seafood. Open during the hub construction with parking available across the street. Portabella, 425 North Francis Street, Madison.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, a guest makes the case that elections should be fun in order to really get people engaged in politics and out to the polls.
First, since Governor Walker unveiled his state budget proposal in early February, the University of Wisconsin system has been looking for ways to deal with a proposed cut of $300 million over 2 years. This week, a handful of UW schools are proposing a significant raise in tuition for a few categories of students in order to try to make things to make ends meet.
UW-Madison, along with eight other schools, want to increase tuition on graduate, international, and non-resident students. They'll make their case to the Board of Regents later this week. Meanwhile, UW-Oshkosh announced today they'll be ending two of the college's sports programs as a cost-cutting measure.
Joining us now to talk about the latest University of Wisconsin system news is Karen Herzog. She covers higher education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So let's start with the news about the proposed tuition hike. In particular, which groups of students are being eyed for higher tuition?
I would say that the majority of the money that they're hoping to generate through tuition increases would come from non-residents. That would be the largest number of students. If you look at the proposal from UW-Madison, Chancellor Blank has put forth a four-year plan. Now, I don't know that the regents could actually approve a four-year plan because they typically are just looking at a budget year. But over 4 years, non-resident undergrad tuition increase that's on the table would generate a total of $147.4 million. And all of the increases that are on the table from UW-Madison, including the professional schools, total $186 million. So you can see that the vast majority is the non-resident undergrads.
And we're also taking a look at, it sounds like, international students and grad students. They're being talked about as well, right?
That's correct. International students, the thinking behind raising tuition for international students is that there are higher costs associated with these students, the handling costs for their applications, and also monitoring requirements that have been put forth by the federal government since 9/11, monitoring requirements of students. So what they're looking at doing potentially is creating a differential, a $1,000 a year increase. And this is Madison. This isn't across the board for all the campuses, but this is Madison, so that those students would pay $1,000 more a year, and then they would their increases in the following years would be the same as non-resident students.
Can you give us a sense of how these new changes, should they go through, would position the University of Wisconsin system as compared to other Big Ten schools in tuition?
Well, there was an interesting case made for UW-Madison's increases. Of course, the flagship is the one that gets the biggest attention and has got the most comparison with the Big Ten other schools. And in the case of tuition for non-resident undergrads, Chancellor Blank points out that if the increases went through, Wisconsin would still be $5,000 less than Michigan for out-of-state tuition, and that's what Michigan currently charges. And it would not be any higher than fourth or fifth in the Big Ten by 2018-19 if the schedule of increases over the next 4 years went through, according to the chancellor. In terms of the other campuses, UW-Milwaukee is also asking to raise non-resident tuition for both undergrad and grad students by a much smaller percentage, 2.5%. The increase at Madison is 11.75%. So much smaller increases at UW-Milwaukee and also the other comprehensive schools. And in the case of, I think there's a couple of graduate programs at UW-Milwaukee, and those increases are like in the neighborhood of 3 to 5.5%.
We're talking right now about some possible tuition hikes for certain groups of students at the UW-Madison campus and beyond, other schools in the system as well. Talking with Karen Herzog right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And one big question on people's mind, Karen, is does this, would this, and could this affect the reciprocity agreement that has existed for a long time between Wisconsin and Minnesota?
That's a great question. As far as I can tell, it's not on the table for discussion. And there's been a lot of talk about that because, of course, there's concern among parents who want to send their students to Twin Cities is the big campus that Wisconsin students attend. But there are also cross-border exchanges, like UW-River Falls gets a lot of students from just across the border in Minnesota. But at this point, there's nothing on the table about changing that, although there are some people who believe that Minnesota students, you could generate a whole lot more money if you considered them non-residents as opposed to residents at the flagship, especially. Somebody today was telling me that represents about $50 million if Minnesota residents attending UW-Madison were charged as non-residents. So it's something that could eventually be on the table, but I'm not getting any indication that anyone wants to put it on the table.
And right now, the tuition for resident undergrads is frozen. Is there any sense that this could change over the next 4 or 5 years?
Well, I think it's a done deal that it will continue for the next 2 years. Beyond that, it's anybody's guess. But the tuition freeze for undergrad residents has been in place for the past 2 years, including this school year. And so a four-year freeze, and then the big question is what happens after the 4 years. Now, the public authority model is still on the table, but I don't think it's going anywhere, which would allow the UW system to set its own tuition. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. The governor's also talked about perhaps putting a cap on future increases to the consumer price index. So it's hard to say. The fear, of course, is that if you freeze tuition for 4 years in a row, that you're going to have to make up for some lost ground at the end of those 4 years, and that would be followed by a huge tuition increase. Of course, the regents will tell you that's not likely. The chancellors will say the same thing because they say the market just would not bear that.
Now, looking at the single biggest proposed tuition increase being requested right now for non-resident students is in UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. They're looking for a 20% hike. What is the justification there?
That's a really interesting story. A month or so, the latest U.S. News and World Report's best graduate school rankings came out. And in those rankings, UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine tied for number 5 in the whole country with Ohio State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And the price that a student from Illinois pays to attend number 5 UW-Madison is less than they would pay to attend their own home state school, Illinois, which is ranked number 19. So they're getting a bargain when they cross the border, and quite a few of them do that. So the belief was that tuition definitely needed to be raised because it's a strong enough program, and also it was so far under market.
Any sense of how this news is going over with student groups so far?
Well, no students want increases in tuition. Non-resident students, I'm sure there are a lot of families who would be upset about that. And, of course, you do run the risk when you raise tuition that, you know, that it's going to be not as attractive to families. You know, some people like to attend the school because it is a bargain. And if it's no longer a bargain, if it's more in line with peers, does it still have the same drawing power? That's the big question. In the past, I believe, I can't remember when it was, but in the past there was a lot of discussion about raising non-resident undergrad tuition, and there was a backlash. And I believe that's a rather sensitive matter, although it does allow the university to generate quite a bit of additional revenue.
You had an interesting fact in your piece I want to ask you about. You wrote that in 1980, a family could send three children to UW-Madison for the cost of sending one child to the flagship today, adjusted for inflation. So in a minute or two, what has changed?
Well, it used to be that state funding covered a majority of the cost of education. It used to be the tuition covered 30% of the cost of an education, and the state covered 70%. And that's now the opposite. The burden of paying for a college education is now much more on families than it was a generation ago. A generation ago, someone could literally work their way through college with summer jobs and you know, reasonable amount of hours during the school year. Now that is no longer possible. You just can't do that. So that there is a significantly higher burden being borne by tuition as opposed to the state. The state has significantly reduced its contribution.
One more bit of news I want to point out. The UW-Oshkosh is making news with the announcement that they'll be cutting two sports programs. What do we know about that?
Well, the decision to cut these programs, I believe, was perhaps in motion before the budget cuts. So while it's being tied to the proposed cuts, there was in 2010, there was an analysis done on the athletics department structure, and there was a financial audit done last year, and what they were looking at is which programs offer the most bang for the buck. They looked at whether the sport had a conference championship to participate in, and just basically making sure that the experience would be optimal for student athletes. So as a result of the analysis, they decided to cut tennis and men's soccer. Men's tennis and men's soccer, and then they're combining men's and women's track and field and men's and women's cross country under restructured coaching staff. So the program cuts, the soccer and tennis cuts, affect a total of about 35 students, and then they also would reduce the number of coaching positions by two. So there would then be 19 varsity sports instead of 21.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the latest cost-cutting measures proposed by some schools in the UW system. And later in the program, we'll talk to a Wisconsin businessman and political blogger about his ideas to change the university system so it's closer to the business community and the citizens of the state.
It is election day here in Wisconsin. A state Supreme Court race as well as a Chief Justice referendum are the biggies today. There are also local elections referenda out there as well. That said, only about 20% of the state's voters are expected to show up.
Maybe the problem is that elections and voting just aren't fun. But according to our next guest, they used to be. Open-air debates, festivals, street theater, and a lot more used to be part of a robust electoral culture. He says bringing those elements back would get more people excited about voting again and could be the shot in the arm our democracy needs, too.
Joining us now is Eric Liu. He's the founder and CEO of Citizen University and the executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, where he recently wrote a piece called The Joy of Voting. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So elections, voting, are we in a rut, a doldrums when it comes to our political participation?
You know, in general, we are. We're in about a 50 or 60-year rut, which happens to be the 50 or so years that our national politics has come to be dominated by television. The more that particularly national politics became a thing that you experienced sitting back as a spectator on your couch through your TV screen, the more that what used to exist, this robust culture of really creative, face-to-face, playful, sometimes raucous participation around campaigns and elections, the more that culture basically withered away. And, you know, part of the argument that I make in this piece and that I would say is, you know, particularly apt on an election day like you're having in Wisconsin right now, is to remember that there used to be a better way, that elections weren't just this sterile, antiseptic thing that you mainly tuned out on TV and only, you know, 20% of us might go to an off-year election and actually cast a ballot. It used to be a thing where people participated because it was that the act of voting was part of a much bigger thing. It was part of being a community member and a co-creator of a community.
Can you describe it for us? What did it used to be like, this sort of festival atmosphere that you described from the past?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about this from the nation's founding, from the earliest days of the Republic through the Civil War era, through the Progressive era, well into the 30s, at every phase in American life, elections used to just be not just focused on the casting of ballots on election day. They would be built up in sort of a carnival festival atmosphere for weeks in advance, where you'd have street theater, parades, debates out in the open-air debates. You'd have rituals of people toasting and fasting and people celebrating their candidates. You'd have plays where people would be depicting candidates and making the case for or against an issue or a cause. You'd have festivals. You'd have bonfires. It was just this sort of thing where people played, I guess is the simplest way to put it. And again, this was before mass entertainment and television, but it was not just about there were no better options for entertainment. It was also about the sense that voting was connected to a larger sense of belonging, belonging to a group, belonging to a club, belonging, yes, to a party, right? And this was a lot about partisan pride and people marching and expressing that. And so part of the belief that I think we've come to accept in American politics is that partisanship is inherently bad. Now, that's not totally true. When you have partisanship that leads to gridlock, like we see in Washington, D.C., where people are just on autopilot ideologically and not thinking for themselves, that's bad. But partisanship as a way of actually getting people to express their beliefs and to do them together in person, in public, in creative ways, that kind of partisanship I'm all for, and that used to be the rule in American politics.
Talking to Eric Liu about the joy of voting and how we've lost that joy, lost that festival atmosphere, and that's part, he says, of why we have low turnout in many elections. Eric, how, if we decide we want to bring this back, how do we start? How do we bring this festival atmosphere of elections back to life?
Well, not to be too glib, but we start to bring it back is the answer. I mean, there's nothing magical about its disappearance other than habits changed, and habits can be rechanged. And I think the other thing that I would add is simply, you know, as with so much that's happening right now in terms of civic renewal in this country, start local, right? It's really hard to feel as an individual voter that you can create a wave of change in a presidential election. But
Eric, are you still there? We've lost Eric Liu. While we bring him on, we'll remind you we're talking to Eric Liu about the idea of bringing fun back to our politics, to our election systems, a festival atmosphere, plays, street theater. You can share your thoughts on this, by the way. Maybe you have an example from real life where you've encountered this kind of fun in elections. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. No luck with Eric Liu so far. He's making the case that our elections have gotten boring, I guess, is what he's saying.
And what about you? Do you think this sort of thing would get you interested in voting again if you've lost interest a little bit? Would this kindle the fires of democracy and get people surging to the polls to have a little street theater? He's also talking about having spirited discussions in pubs and debates, battles of the bands where one person represents a particular candidate or the other. All kinds of options there for rekindling this sort of festival atmosphere around democracy, or are we simply just too far around the bend, too cynical about politics, too into our own personal world and our devices?
You can call in and share your thoughts now while we try to get Eric Liu back on the line at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea, bringing the fun back into politics? 800-642-1234. Our guest, Eric Liu, has, in his piece, pointed toward the Tea Party and the Occupy movement of people who created this festival atmosphere, whether you agree with one or disagree with both politically. Do you think that they're good examples of engaging people with politics again? 800-642-1234. There's Eric Liu back with us. Eric, talking about how we can bring this era of fun back. And I was just mentioning, you point to the Tea Party and the Occupy movement of people who have created a more fun atmosphere of politics. Can you expand on that a little?
Sure. And sorry, my line got dropped there for a second. But, you know, in our modern times, I think
you know, number one, start local to revive this. But number two, you know, this is not a partisan or this does not belong to one side or the other. Both the Tea Party and the Occupy movements, I think, had some instinct about how to revive a sense of this playful participation, the theatricality, whether you're talking about the tri-cornered hats and the don't tread on these flags and the colonial garb that a lot of early Tea Party ralliers brought to their gatherings, or about the Guy Fawkes masks and the 99% iconography and the imagery and language that the Occupy organizers brought. They had a little bit of the spirit of, we're going to rally in the public square. We're going to be seeing each other. We're going to face each other. We're going to feel a collective strength of voice and creativity and agency. And, you know, I love both of those things just from the vantage point of citizen empowerment and citizen engagement. I mean, all my work.
Let's see if we can get one call in this quickly before we have to let you go. Jim and Tomahawk, you're up.
Well, thank you very much. One small item, since I grew up in a family with old people in the generations. My grandfather was born on St. Patrick's Day in 1862, just my grandfather.
Wow.
So there were generations that kept skipping and skipping, so, you know, I go way back in just short order. Those lively and spirited dances and all of that, from what I get from my history, is that those were damn serious dances and festivals. These things were serious.
Jim, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate that. Is there something to that, Eric? We may remember them as festivals, but they were serious, and we were pretty short on time.
You bet. I think, and that is exactly the combination of playful purposefulness that we need to bring back to the politics. It's not about fun and games. It's about being in a collective, shared, creative experience with each other that reminds us we're all in it together, whatever side we're on.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Liu, founder and CEO of Citizen University. We've got a link to his piece, The Joy of Voting, on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can share your examples, your thoughts, maybe your hopes on the Central Time Facebook page as well. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The University of Wisconsin system has been a hot topic in the ongoing budget discussions in Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker proposed several controversial provisions in his biennial budget, including $300 million in budget cuts over 2 years and a rewrite of the Wisconsin idea. Governor Walker has since backed off rewriting the university's mission.
Our next guest says Governor Walker was right to tweak the university's mission. That's just one of his ideas for how the university system could do a better job of aligning itself with the business community and everyone else outside the academic world. John Torinas is with us now to share his ideas. He's chairman of the company Serigraph, former business editor and columnist at the Milwaukee newspapers. He blogs at Straight Talk from the Heartland. John, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, as we mentioned, there was that proposed change to the UW idea, the mission statement there. It got withdrawn, but you think maybe it's time to tweak it, to change it. Why do you think this would be a good time to revisit that?
Well, it was greeted with a big uproar from Walker opponents, but, you know, and I think it was because of the way it was sort of dropped as a bombshell and as a surprise. I think it had gone through any kind of a dialogue process, it wouldn't have been so controversial. I mean, this thing has been around since the beginning, well, about the 1900s, and it's probably time to take a look at it. I know I was on a commission in 97. It was a jobs commission, and we looked at the Wisconsin idea, and we tweaked it. It was 30 citizen leaders in Wisconsin, chaired by Catherine Lyle, the then president of the university system, and she didn't think it was an inviolate concept that couldn't be tweaked and amended and freshened and sharpened for the age we live in. So, you know, I think Walker was unfairly criticized or his staff, I should say. I'm not sure he even knew about it, but his staff was unfairly criticized for daring to tamper with the idea.
You make the case in a couple of blog posts that one of the things that could change is more focus on the system's role in job creation, in job training, entrepreneurship. What kind of things would you like to see happen in the system?
Well, I think, you know, we need a commission to sit down, or the regents need to sit down and do a serious strategic planning session for exercise for the university. They haven't done it since 1971. Actually, my Aunt Mary Walter was on the on the State Board of Regents in 71 when they did reorganize. They took the two systems and put them into the present system of today. But that was 44 years ago. It's about time to take another look at it. And the idea that part of the mission of the university is to train people for jobs is not a bad idea. Now, it's not the only idea that should be incorporated in, quote, the Wisconsin idea, unquote. There's other things that could be put in as well. I don't know if you've ever taken a look at Section 36, which incorporates the idea, it's the purpose and mission of the university. It's over 200 words long. It ambles all over the place. There's all kinds of unstrategic concepts and language in it, a lot of tactical stuff. So it really does need a rewrite. And there are plenty of burning issues and changes in the way the world works today that could be incorporated into the new Wisconsin idea. And that's exactly what we called it. We called it the new Wisconsin idea on that commission. It said that it was brief. It was only about 30 words. Innovative learning opportunities should be available to all Wisconsin citizens in a seamless manner throughout their lives, delivered wherever they may be. So some of the pieces that are incorporated in that are that, number one, lifelong learning. That's not in the original concept. Number two, global, because Wisconsin alumni are all over the world. The idea of digital fluency needs to be baked in. The idea that the university has a dual mission on the supply side to turn out graduates, but also everybody knows in the innovation economy that powerful universities and their R&D figure heavily in the prosperity of the state. So that whole idea that the university has a demand side obligation as well as a supply side. So all of those are, you know, big ideas that are not currently expressed in the Wisconsin idea. So I think we should do a rewrite.
Even if it's not expressed so clearly in the idea, isn't the university doing some of these things, doing more online education? There is entrepreneurship. There is support for business out there.
Yeah, de facto, they are doing it. But it's not, you know, you got it. You're a communicator, Rob, and I am too. And, you know, in order to have good focus and good execution in an organization, you have to sit down and think hard about your strategy, and it's usually summed up broadly in the mission of the organization. So if the mission is meandering and unclear and outdated, that's not a good place to start for getting clarity on the execution in the organization. So I'm a big backer of a new Blue Ribbon Commission pulled from smart people across the state. And let's sit down and rework this. There's a tremendous number of challenges facing the university today, not the least of which is the budgetary challenges. There's also the tuition issue and student debt issues and on and on and on. And the whole issue of how you engage the university with the world of commerce, much as MIT and Stanford have done so successfully. So we got a lot of things to hash out. And then if you're on the faculty side or the employee side, you want to talk some more about, is tenure still a viable concept, shared governance. So all of those things are being debated, but they're not being dialogued in a very mature, adult, intelligent manner. They're just sort of throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks inside the Beltway.
Talking to John Torinas. He is a business executive, a political blogger, former business editor and columnist in Milwaukee newspapers. He says it's time to revisit the Wisconsin idea, the mission statement of the UW system, reevaluate what it does. John, getting into some of the practical ideas you come up with, you say too much focus now on the Madison campus, maybe too much investment compared to others, not enough in the Milwaukee campus in particular. Can you expand on that a little?
Well, again, the Wisconsin idea, going back to Charles Van Hise, who was the president of the university at the turn of the 20th century, that's where the idea that came from, that the borders of the state are the borders of the university. And he actually said, "I shall never rest content until the beneficent," lovely word, "influences of the university are made available to every home in the state." So that's the genesis of the common understanding of the Wisconsin idea, namely that the borders of the state are the borders of the university. Obviously, that doesn't apply anymore because we're now in a global world. But the idea that the university be there for everybody is it goes way back, and I don't think you don't need to lose that. You can keep that. You can keep the sifting and winnowing for truth. You can keep the part of the idea that the university was there to facilitate good governance. So the venerable ideas and the high-minded ideals can still be incorporated. So I would do that in a rewrite.
Yeah, but with the Milwaukee campus in particular, what would you like to see change there?
We all love our flagship university, and you know, I went there for summer school. My son graduated from there, so we love the university. We love that it's a, you know, one of the great assets of Wisconsin that we're known for, not just athletics but academics. But the mission, as I say, the mission of the university system is statewide, and it's the view of some of us out there who are battling to try to make things better. For instance, in the central city of Milwaukee, the system is not giving us all the help we should get. I think Madison is such a powerful institution that it can take care of itself. And the system ought to be reorganized so that UW-Milwaukee can become the Michigan State, to the equivalent to the University of Michigan. And that's where the poverty issues are. That's where the social issues are. Not all of them, of course. They're there in Beloit, and they're there in Green Bay, and they're there in Madison. But we need to organize the university regionally so that the university can be, again, on the demand side of the equation, can create jobs and better, and by the way, quality jobs, not just jobs, but high-quality jobs, high-pay jobs, so that we can raise people out of poverty. So, and Madison, UW-Madison basically operates generally inside the borders of Dane County. And so it's great for the south-central part of the state, but they're not extending their reach enough to the other parts of the state. That's my view.
And you've suggested that the UW system president, currently Ray Cross, though he says he'll leave if the budget cuts stay in place, but the UW system president should consider moving office to Milwaukee, basing the UW system there, in effect.
Yeah, you know, the great university successes these days are where academia is married up to the powerful business community. So you take, why does Minnesota do better than we do in Wisconsin? And I would argue that one of the reasons is that the state house and the center of the university and the business center are all together. And in Wisconsin, they're bifurcated. We've got the state house and the university center in Madison, but the business community is centered in Milwaukee. So I think that the regents and the system leadership would have a more even-handed view of their statewide responsibilities if Van Hise was abandoned and they moved the system headquarters over to Milwaukee, which is the center of the business community.
We're talking to business executive and political blogger John Torinas about what the UW system can do to align itself more closely with the business community and to serve the everyday citizens of Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think the University of Wisconsin system should do differently to connect better with Wisconsin's business community and citizens? And how could the system make itself more attractive to lawmakers? How would you rewrite the Wisconsin idea if you think that's a good idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with businessman and blogger John Torinas about how he thinks the University of Wisconsin system could better align itself with the non-academic community in the state.
And you can join in. What do you think should be done differently at the UW system to make it closer to the business community to serve the needs of people, even if they're not currently students or working at a university? What do you think of this idea to move the HQ of the UW system from Madison to Milwaukee? Does the Madison campus get too much attention? Other campuses like Milwaukee and others, not enough. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'll go right to a caller. Let's talk to Albert in Racine. Albert, hi.
Oh, hey. I mean, yeah, wow. You know, bringing the business community more into the school. You know, you got the whole project with Halliburton and the Halliburton Geology Center at the UW. And it's just like, I don't know where to get an idea like that. It's just really absurd.
Talking to John Torinas about the UW system. John, some concerns out there, it sounds like, about over-commercializing the university.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of ducking your head in the sand. We live in a commercial world, and I know that once upon a time, the Ivy Tower was supposed to be without commercial taint. I reject that notion entirely. Stanford is one of the great universities. They're thoroughly enmeshed with Silicon Valley, and they get, they're one of the greatest endowed universities in the world, maybe the highest, because they create entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs make a lot of money. When they get enough money, they don't have to do with it, and they give it back to their alma mater. So some of that happens in Madison, and it's starting to happen a little bit in Milwaukee. So I just think that it's, you know, if you're a professor and you got a great idea, you came up with an innovation, what good does it do if it just sits there in the shelf in your lab? You know, you want to see your idea out in the real world, being deployed, being used, you know, for the betterment of mankind. So I don't think most professors have a problem with putting their ideas to work.
I want to talk about the politics a little, John. There's been a tension, I think is a polite way to say, a friction between the UW system, especially UW-Madison, and legislators, particularly some Republican lawmakers. Do you think some of the changes you're talking about can make a more harmonious working relationship there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the university needs to play for the long run. They need to be even-handed about how they come down on the various sides of the aisle. But think about it in the present context. You know, businessmen and Republicans tend to get along in the present context. There are a few pro-growth Democrats around, but there are not enough of them. There used to be a lot of them. There aren't in many anymore, and a couple of them just retired, like Tim Cullen. But, you know, so if the Republican legislators perceive the university as being ingrained in the innovation economy, I think they'd be kinder to it. But I think they see it as more, you know, dominated by the left-to-center politics at UW-Madison. And let's, you know, that doesn't mean that every department over there is left-to-center, but I think we all realistically know that a lot of the criticism for Republicans comes from UW-Madison. So if I were positioning the UW strategically, I would be much more neutral about it. And I think if you moved the system headquarters to Milwaukee, you know, that would accomplish a lot of that.
Talking to John Torinas about recent pieces he's written about the UW system's mission and how it might need to change, he says. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Monroe. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think you've got a guest who's got entirely flawed thinking. He wants to point to Stanford and then all of a sudden say that somehow being liberal on a campus is bad. And then, and I'm sure as a businessman, he would, in Milwaukee, would be very upset to hear someone say from New York or L.A. refer to, you know, Wisconsin as a flyover state from a business sense, yet he thinks somehow putting an office in Milwaukee will improve things because there's poverty apparently only in Milwaukee. There isn't poverty out in rural areas. And businesses outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin businesses like Quick Trip, like Line and Kugel's, like Swiss Colony, aren't having a major effect. He's following a line of thinking that you find primarily in MBA programs, which is trying to justify, looking for theories to justify your beliefs.
Joe, thanks for the call. John, he's saying you're maybe overstating the benefits of putting more into Milwaukee, it sounds like.
Well, actually, you know, I'm just being pragmatic on the political side of that, which is where he started, and then he ended up on other stuff. But I'm just being politically pragmatic, okay? And I'm not bashing liberals or bashing the Tea Party. I'm just saying that the university ought to position itself for the long term, which is to be even-handed politically. As regarding the effects of the university on the economy, I would take the university and I would organize it like the economy works. The economy generally works in clusters, and clusters generally are regionally oriented. So paper making in the northern part of the state, and let's take New North, which is new northeastern Wisconsin. So they have the 18 counties up there are already doing what I'm talking about. So UW Oshkosh and UW Green Bay have gone together. They have a K-16 council that is coordinating the educational offerings all the way from K through 16, through the technical college, through the universities, with the direction of the economy of the northeastern Wisconsin. So for instance, if Marinette Marine and Marinette needs people that can work building ships, they organize the tech colleges and the universities to supply the labor for that booming part of the economy. So it just makes sense to me to intertwine and connect the academia and the educational offerings with what's going on in the economy. You know, the university is one of our greatest, greatest things. You had to pick two strategies in the state of Wisconsin to make things better. You'd pick an entrepreneurial strategy. Those are the guys that create all the new jobs, the hot new jobs, the good quality jobs, the high paid jobs. Those are the jobs that are going to keep our kids and grandkids here, as opposed to the present brain drain of about 10,000 graduates a year. And then the second biggest the thrust would be education and training. And it, if you've got high levels of education and training, it's a competitive advantage. And Wisconsin has that, so we do have that advantage. But we're losing our kids because the university's got to get engaged in the economy and create the jobs that keeps the kids here. These things are intertwined, and I don't see why people have a hard time understanding that.
Now, you've obviously this has been a political issue lately. You've mentioned that our callers have pointed to that too. Has it always been that way? Has the UW system always been a political football, or I guess basketball, to be more timely?
I don't think so. I think there was, you know, a lot of bipartisan support up until maybe 15, 20 years ago, and I don't see why that shouldn't return. Why the university shouldn't be supported universally by Republicans and Democrats? And I'm a pretty objective guy. I'm a former journalist, and I try to be even-handed and objective about it. I'm more interested in policy than politics. And you know, so if you got good policy, that leads to good politics, and I would say it probably leads to bipartisan politics. I don't see these as partisan issues.
Do you see any chance that there will be some kind of blue ribbon commission to tackle these issues that you're talking about and others, and who would have to take the initiative to do that?
Well, a lot of people are pushing for that, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I don't know why the regents don't launch it. You know, Catherine Lyle did it in 2000 and 2003. She called four economic summits. She realized a couple of things, that in order for the university to be politically popular, it needed to be involved in job creation and prosperity, not just turning out graduates. Now, there, you know, you need the general side of education, philosophy and poetry and communication and psychology. Everybody needs the soft side. An employee needs that. But they also need the hard side, the technical side, the engineering, the IT skills. So, you know, she saw that the demand side of the university had to be emphasized. She also realized that it politically that would position the university better with the legislatures and the string of governors. If the university is central to the prosperity of the citizens, how then can politicians take on the university as a punching bag, which is what's happening right now?
We'll leave it there. John, thanks so much for joining us again.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's John Torinas. You can read more about his thoughts. They're linked on the Central Time Facebook page. A rock music mystery may be a step closer to being solved with the auction of the original lyrics of Don McLean's epic hit song, American Pie.
McLean put the lyrics along with the working notes and lots of drafts up for sale. It ended up pulling in $1.2 million in auction this morning.
The mystery is the lyrics themselves. They've had rock fans trying to figure out the meaning of lines. There are even websites that do this. Lines like, when the jester sang for the king and queen in a coat he borrowed from James Dean.
Or the helter skelter in the summer swelter, the marching band refusing to yield. These are all lyrics we've kicked around with our friends before trying to figure out what exactly he's getting at there. Now we might know.
Yeah, McLean says his notes and the drafts of the song are going to answer all the questions. All will be revealed. I don't know, maybe he was just doing it to try to drive up the auction price.
I don't know, but I'd always heard that this song was about the day that Buddy Holly died, that plane crash, right? That's what most people think.
Well,
that's
the day the music died part, but there's lots of lines that appear to have nothing to do with that particular incident, I guess. So I just kind of let it wash over me over the years, to be honest, and didn't put too much thought into
it. Well, I hope whoever bought it tells the rest of us what it means.
That'd be funny.
That's my one
I'm laying down $1.2 million, now I'm the only person who knows the secret. Well, we'll go out with a little bit of Don McLean and American Pie.
I started singing by. Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.